1260 AM Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Israel is expanding its military operation against Hamas in Gaza, but there are concerns for the safety of the more than 200 hostages trapped in Gaza and for the more than 2 million people living there. Communications have been severed. Jason Shawa is a Palestinian-American living in Gaza with his wife and their two children.
Keep waking up in a panic, in a frenzy. They have nightmares, and moms and dads are having a hell of a time trying to keep them calm at night. It's just horrible. I mean, what else can I say?
The manhunt in Maine is over for the suspected mass shooter. Robert Card was found dead Friday of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. State Public Safety Director Mike Soschuk said he was found dead at a recycling center.
He was found inside one of those boxes that was unlocked from the outside.
He said it was an overflow parking lot across the street. This is ABC News. Today is the DEA's Drug Takeback Day. It offers a nationwide way to dispose of old, unused, or unwanted prescription drugs.
For anyone worried about dropping off unused drugs at the DEA, they promise it's
completely anonymous.
Deputy Assistant DEA Administrator Matt Strait says it's worth finding a drop-off site near you.
Substances that are in the house can be utilized by family members for some unintended purpose beyond that which their doctor prescribed it.
You can find the nearest drop-off site at DEATakeback.com. Andy Field, ABC News.
A judge in New York ruled Friday Ivanka Trump must appear to testify in person at her father's fraud trial. An appeal is likely. And Sam Bankman-Fried, the disgraced crypto executive, took the stand in his own defense Friday at his fraud trial. He has testified about the collapse of his company, FTX, trying to say he made mistakes but did not defraud anyone. Brian Clark, ABC News.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, can potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. More prospective college students are taking a community's or campus's political climate into consideration when choosing a school. Eric Galatis reports.
High school graduates are considering state and university positions on a number of hot-button issues, including abortion, gun, and LGBTQ laws as they decide where to invest in higher education. John Marcus with the nonprofit Hechinger Report says many students have gotten offers from colleges in states with laws and policies they disagree with and have chosen not to go.
And if students are making decisions based on how well a college might have handled, for example, a controversial speaker and thereby alienated some prospective applicants, that's going to hurt that college.
The Hechinger Report's new college welcome guide ranks four-year schools on free speech, the number of students from rural areas, and lists those that have banned diversity, equity, and inclusion. It also provides data on gender and racial diversity among students and faculty, the number of veteran students enrolled, and racially motivated hate crimes. Marcus says students with more liberal views are angry about laws banning diversity and abortion, while students on the right aren't happy about conservative speakers being shouted down or canceled.
They also say that they don't feel they can speak freely in a classroom out of fear that they'll be called out by their classmates or even by their faculty.
A recent survey found that nearly a third of students do not feel they belong and are more likely to drop out. One in four Hispanic students have experienced disrespect, discrimination, or harassment. Marcus notes self-segregation at colleges comes at a high cost.
If we're not around other people who are different from us, how will we ever really understand those other points of view?
This is Eric Galatis. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
OptUS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
This is Morning Cannolis, and I am Jim Santel. Thank you for joining me for this, our second hour on Saturday, October 28th. This, our review, our analysis, our discussion with you of the most important issues, the stories, the events that animate our lives in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Speaking of justice, spent most of our first hour this morning talking about the United States Supreme Court, this significant guns case coming up in about 10 days to be resolved ultimately by the United States Supreme Court, probably in June of next year, having to do with the latest interpretation of the Second Amendment, watching that, monitoring that oral argument and the decision coming down in 2024. Supreme Court is also going to be back in business once again next week. We have previously talked on this broadcast about the six different days in its October sitting in which the Supreme Court has reviewed cases already, cases having to do with the legitimacy of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the application of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the whistleblower standards, but the levels of proof a whistleblower needs to prove to establish her or his case, and also this major case having to do with race and politics coming out of South Carolina that argued before the Supreme Court on October 11th, one of the major gerrymandering cases that's going to be decided by the Supreme Court, again, coming out of South Carolina, determining whether or not race was used as a proxy for politics when the legislature there drew some lines in the wake of the 2020 census. Supreme Court in business again this coming week. Four different cases, three different days, beginning Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, talking about those, giving us some notice of what's coming up, including on Monday, a forfeiture case on Monday, October 30th, having to do with all kinds of things related to post-seizure, probable cause, whether or not judicial forfeiture proceedings need to be guided by something called the speedy trial test, and that was set forth by the 11th Circuit, or a three-part test by the judges in some other circuits, the Fifth Circuit, the Second Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, including in our own Seventh Circuit. So what we have here is a classic split in the circuits on interpreting and applying forfeiture laws when it comes to judicial forfeiture, probable cause, all those kinds of things. That's going to be argued on Monday in a case called Culley versus Marshall, 9 o'clock Eastern Time on Monday, the United States Supreme Court, addressing forfeiture and the standards, the process by which the courts and the government in particular is obliged to provide due process, as Mark said in our previous hour, to those people who are facing forfeiture of properties in the criminal setting. It's actually a civil setting, but in the wake, typically, of criminal matters in our federal courts. Culley versus Marshall being argued on Monday morning, on Tuesday, Halloween, October 31st, United States Supreme Court taking up what it has plainly established as a great interest of it. It's interested, again, not only in the Fifth Circuit, as we said before, interested, as we'll discover in future broadcasts, tremendously on addressing the legitimacy of our administrative agencies. We already have that CFPB case pending. Others are coming up, major cases attacking, if you will, the agencies and the prerogatives of agency officials to make decisions. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court's turning to another one of its apparently favorite focuses, which is social media. Social media on its docket in a couple of cases on Tuesday, October 31st. One of them called O'Connor-Ratcliffe versus Garnier, and they also called the other one called Linkey versus Freed. The cases themselves raise some interesting issues. The question in the O'Connor case is whether a public official, somebody who's in a public position, engages in state action, government action, that's therefore subject to the First Amendment, by blocking someone, blocking an individual from that official's personal social media account. In other words, the government official has a personal account, and that official is using that personal account to feature, to highlight, to present information about their official job and communicating job-related matters with the public, all kinds of things that are official in nature on the person's personal account. And the question is, when that person decides to block somebody on their personal account, therefore presumably denying them access to this public information otherwise available to them, is there government liability under the First Amendment? Official state action. Fascinating concept, right? The interface between government and social media. That's O'Connor-Ratcliffe versus Garnier, the much-related case. Linkey versus Freed. Linkey versus Freed also being argued, same kind of thing with our public officials. Social media activity constitutes state action if the official used the account to perform a governmental duty under the authority of his office. A little bit different than the case in O'Connor-Ratcliffe, but the same kind of thing. The court taking up both of those cases in tandem, determining whether or not what the law says about this interface between the official work of public officials on their personal websites and their responsibilities to the public under the First Amendment. Linkey is the one case, Linkey versus Freed. O'Connor-Ratcliffe versus Garnier is the other. The United States Supreme Court focusing on social media. And again, this interface between government and personal social media accounts. What can you do? What can you not do that may run afoul of the First Amendment access by all of us to the public information that might be provided on a personal account as opposed to a public official account? Fascinating stuff. Those cases coming up on Tuesday. Along the way, not on the docket yet, but arguably, again, showing this interest that the Supreme Court has in social media cases. It has granted cert, certiorari, basically saying, we want to review additional cases also in this area of postings, things on social media. What did it do fairly recently? A couple of additional cases just decided to take by the Supreme Court in the recent days of its present term. Recently, the Supreme Court agreed to take on two landmark additional media cases with enormous implications for online speech. Not that those others do not, but these perhaps even greater. The court will determine if laws passed by the states of Texas and Florida recently are violating First Amendment rights once again by requiring social platforms, the social media platforms like Meta and X, formerly Twitter and Google, requiring them to host content that they would otherwise block. Let me parse that out a little bit. The tech industry groups, including once again Google and Twitter, now X and Meta, say that these laws that require them that to host this content, even though they would otherwise block it for being offensive, being inappropriate, requiring them to do that, the tech groups say those laws are unconstitutional, inappropriately passed by the legislatures, and violate the private company's First Amendment rights. They say this: telling private websites they must give equal treatment to extremist hate isn't just unwise, it is unconstitutional. And that's where the rub, that's where these cases come from. And we, that is the tech companies themselves, are pushing back on these state laws coming out of Texas and Florida that require them to enable these hate statements and host the content that they would otherwise block. They say they look forward to demonstrating to the court in the future that these cases, these situations, these prohibitions on their capacity to block hate speech online is not only unwise, it's also unconstitutional. And that's going to be before the court. The court has taken that up. Supporters of these state laws claim that the social media companies are biased against conservatives, their statements, and they're illegally censoring their own views. Ken Paxton, who we've talked about, the Texas Attorney General, who was recently impeached by the legislature there, survived a vote in the Senate. Ken Paxton, the Attorney General there in the state of Texas, said this. He said these massive corporate entities, meaning the social media providers, cannot continue to go unchecked as they silence the voices of millions of Americans. He plainly is in support of those laws coming out of Texas and Florida, being opposed on constitutional First Amendment and also privacy rights, the rights of the companies under privacy laws to do what they want, to block the hate speech, the inappropriate postings, which again are the subject now of these cases, now before the Supreme Court, not yet scheduled for oral argument, but at some point in the near future, that is going to happen. In addition, just this past week, further indicating the Supreme Court's interest in these social media cases, Supreme Court agreed to hear a case that will determine the extent to which the government, and in particular the Biden administration, you've heard a lot about this on the news, can provide and tell social media companies to censor or suppress certain kinds of information, specifically having to do with inaccurate, uninformed, simply wrong information about COVID-19. Recall this issue? The administration attempting to encourage and stop the posting of inaccurate information about COVID on social media platforms. The lawsuit, which is filed by attorneys general from Missouri and Louisiana, argues that the pressure from the Biden administration violates First Amendment rights, First Amendment freedom of speech rights. And the Louisiana Solicitor General said, "We are pleased to learn the U.S. Supreme Court will take up this case, giving us yet another opportunity to defend the people," she said, "from this assault on our First Amendment rights. It brings us one step closer to reestablishing the protections guaranteed to us in the Constitution under the First Amendment." Again, the Supreme Court paused an injunction, previously paused an injunction, blocking the government's interaction with social media platforms. And the conservatives on the court dissented to that, all of that, bringing this issue now to the Supreme Court, whether or not the administration can stop the posting of inaccurate, misleading information about COVID online, and whether that's a violation of the state's rights, of others' rights to hear this information, to have the access to it under the First Amendment. All of these cases, much related, raise interesting questions about the interface, once again, of the Constitution and of the social media platforms, the rights that they have to ensure that the things that are posted are within the ambit of reasonableness and rationality. The information is provided and not incendiary and hate-induced. All of that also coming up from the United States Supreme Court in the near future. We've got one more case also coming up on Wednesday, on the November 1st. It's called Vital versus Elster. Vital versus Elster. In the midst of all of the other serious cases we're talking about and very serious subject matter this morning, when we come back, I'm going to tell you about Vital versus Elster, the attorney who brought this case involving a trademark interest that he has with respect to a statement, or at least some language related to our former President Donald Trump. When we come back right after this break, I'm going to tell you about Vital versus Elster and what the Supreme Court's going to be talking about, trademark case, this coming Wednesday. Stay tuned for that discussion.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know what's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Here's your updated forecast. 35 this afternoon, under cloudy skies, west winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. 22 tonight, chance of snow. Tomorrow, high of 35, about an inch of snow Monday night. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley on Lake Air WLAK, 1260 AM. Right now, 30.
Like smelt fries and music on the river, we're uniquely Amory. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK, Amory's radio station. Our awesome farmers market and the Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
We are back here on Morning Cannolis, talking in the previous segment and this one as well about things coming up before your United States Supreme Court this coming week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the cases before the United States Supreme Court, oral argument, which you can hear live going on the Supreme Court website. You can also hear them recorded if you don't have a chance to hear it live, especially focusing again on Halloween on October 31st on the first of these social media cases and the interface between government and the private rights of the companies themselves, how that interfaces with public officials and the things that they may post on their personal websites. Also, again, the Supreme Court indicating it will review cases involving government involvement with these online providers. Information that is wrong and inaccurate. What can government do when it comes to stopping or suppressing that information from being posted online? Fascinating First Amendment cases. We'll be watching all of those. We'll also be watching on Wednesday the United States Supreme Court taking up a case called Vital versus Elster. Vital versus Elster, and again, this one is somewhat tongue-in-cheek, perhaps a lighter aspect from an otherwise very serious morning broadcast this Saturday morning. What's going on here is that a California lawyer who is mocking the former president, his name is Donald Trump, with the phrase, "Trump too small," now embroiled in a trademark battle that's going before the Supreme Court this coming Wednesday. In 2018, this attorney, his name is Stephen Elster, that's the name of the case, applied to secure the trademark for the phrase "Trump too small" through the U.S. Patent and Trademark Offices. And that office denied the application. And according to all the reporting in this case, the position taken by Mr. Elster, he won on appeal in the district court. And the trademark office then filed an appeal of that decision, which is now moving on to the United States Supreme Court. In this case, which again, it does not involve, this is one of the few pieces of litigation out there in which the former president himself is not a party, does not personally involve himself in this particular matter. Elster's attorneys, however, arguing that their client's First Amendment rights to criticize public figures, presumably including the former president, shouldn't be infringed by this government office, and that the court siding with the trademark office would amount to the government basically controlling the citizens' constitutionally protected speech about elected officials. The trademark office itself counters that the T-shirt design violates, hold on, a 1946 statute that bars trademarks that feature a person's name without first obtaining their consent. And this, of course, this trademark office inside the U.S. Department of Commerce effectively amounts to the Biden administration protecting Biden's chief rival from having his name misused for commercial purposes. So interesting, thus the tongue-in-cheek. The reference is presumably to Donald Trump's overall approach to governing. Again, the attorney wants to be able to trademark this phrase and use it, Trump too small. It also inappropriately, you probably recall, mocks a 2016 exchange during that election. The former president and future president at that time having this exchange with Senator Marco Rubio, who was at that time also a candidate for the presidency. He was challenging Donald Trump for the Republican nomination. Trump referred to the Florida senator as Little Marco. Remember this exchange? And Rubio countered that Trump's hands were small, an attack that regrettably, in the midst of a campaign for the highest land in the office, Donald Trump felt the need to respond to. And he simply said, look at those hands. Are these hands small? He actually didn't simply say that. He said more. I'm not going to talk more about what he said in that debate, but that's the circumstance under which we get the Trump too small language. And believe it or not, that case is now before the United States Supreme Court on whether or not this particular attorney, Mr. Elster, can in fact trademark that phrase, wants to post it presumably on sweatshirts and T-shirts and mugs, those kinds of things. Question about whether or not the trademark officials were right in denying him access on the basis that he did not get permission from the person being mocked politically and out there. Interesting case, a little bit lighter fare than the other things that we have talked about to this point. As always, we appreciate your calls, your comments, both written and oral. We've also got Dick also on the line from Madison this morning. Dick, glad to have you with us this morning. Your comment or question?
Or maybe not, because I was going to bring Trump up again.
All right. Go right ahead.
All right. This week with the nonsense that he pulled in court again, and I keep hearing this, and then I'll try and tie his daughter into this a little bit now, because she's supposedly being compelled to appear in court next week, which she'll use the system and appeal like crazy to try and stay away, whereas the father was not compelled to be there and turn that courtroom into a circus and did so. But my question is this gag order thing, and I keep hearing this nonstop thing about, well, there's no precedence for putting a former president in jail. Well, then I wish a judge somewhere would step up and set one. That's the only way we'll get one.
Right, Dick. Dick, appreciate the call for a number of different reasons. One is that the two judges we heard from, a federal judge and a state court judge, I want to talk about that right now. So your call is hugely timely this morning. But those state court judges, the state court judge, the federal judge, perhaps moving in that direction. And the distinction that they are making, consistent with what you just said, is they're saying that, yes, you may be running for the presidency of the United States of America, but in my court, they're saying, you are like any other defendant. You're like any other defendant. Both of them have said that. Let's talk exactly about what you've described just this past week. Let's begin with that state court action. This is the state civil action pending in front of Judge Arthur Engron. We've talked about him a lot. We know that in a previous week, the judge already imposed a $5,000 sanction on the former president. Why? Because he failed to remove from his own website this scurrilous, completely unfounded claim that the judge's law clerk was having a relationship with the Chuck Schumer, the majority leader in the Senate, completely false, directed that be taken down. And when that didn't happen, Judge Engoron, pursuant to his own previous order, directed that the president pay $5,000. Believe it or not, it happened again this past week, Dick, and that's why I think you're calling in. What happens is on Wednesday, once again, Donald Trump, believe it or not, on the witness stand, Dick, as you just said, for the first time in recent history, he's appeared there before, on the witness stand being questioned by the judge about his latest affront, his latest violation of that so-called gag order, really not a gag order, but an order that requires him to conform to the rules of the court, and the judge imposes a $10,000 fine. When we come back, I'm going to tell you more about what happened in that case, the predicates for it, and where we go from there, not only in the state case, but also the federal case. Stay with us for that reporting as well.
In touch with the City of Lakes. In touch with you. This is Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK, Amory's radio station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark.
Israel is expanding its military operation against Hamas in Gaza, but there are concerns for the safety of the more than 200 hostages trapped in Gaza and for the more than 2 million people living there. Communications have been severed. Jason Shawaz, a Palestinian-American living in Gaza with his wife and their two children.
Keep waking up in a panic, in a frenzy. They have nightmares, and moms and dads are having a hell of a time trying to keep them calm at night. It's just horrible. I mean, what else can I say?
The manhunt in Maine is over for the suspected mass shooter. Robert Card was found dead Friday of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. State Public Safety Director Mike Soschuk said he was found dead at a recycling center.
He was found inside one of those boxes that was unlocked from the outside.
He said it was an overflow parking lot across the street. This is ABC News.
For WLAK News, I'm James Kelly. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has unveiled the draft of their sharp-tailed grouse management plan for the next 10 years. The plan will be open to public comment until November 17th, and residents can also provide comments during a public meeting on November 8th. The plan would focus management on the existing core of grouse in northern Wisconsin, develop cooperative partnerships between public and private organizations, and implement habitat strategies to maintain population. Wisconsin residents who use natural gas to heat their homes may see a 20% decrease in heating costs this year, but experts still predict an expensive winter. Historic price data from the United States Energy Information Administration shows heating costs are still expected to be the third most expensive recorded winter. About two-thirds of all Wisconsin households use gas furnaces for heating, but customers who use electric or propane to stay warm could also see a small heating bill decrease. And that's what you need to know. I'm James Kelly, WLAK News.
Our daughter Jessie loves playing detective.
A clue.
But since we discovered she has sensitive skin, we've been playing detective too.
We thought the problem was our puppy.
But it was actually our old detergent.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So we switched to Tide Free and Gentle. Tide cleans better than the leading competitive free detergent, and it doesn't leave behind irritating residues.
Plus, Tide Free and Gentle has no dyes or perfumes, so it's gentle on her skin.
Case closed.
If it's got to be clean, it's got to be Tide Free and Gentle.
Celebrate this Oktoberfest with Walter's Showview Summer Club. Enjoy our special German platter that includes a German sausage topped with sauerkraut and a pork schnitzel. Sauerbraten that is topped with sauerkraut and gravy, and our special Oktoberfest beers and wines. Don't forget to check out our authentic soup and salad bar and our Sunday brunch. Learn more at shoreviewsummerclub.weebly.com or call us 715-268-8774. 715-268-8774. 68-87-74. Walter Shoreview Summer Club. Come and enjoy today.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
And we are back, taking up in this segment the encouragement, the invitation from great caller Dick, who's talking about these orders coming out of a state court, a federal court, to appropriately prevent the former president, defendant in both of those cases, from engaging in conversation that may affect the jury pool, that may affect witnesses, that may affect the administration of justice generally, specifically focusing on the civil fraud trial in front of Judge Arthur Engoron that continues this past week again next week. Featured prominently during the course of the trial this past week was the testimony of Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen, the president's former so-called fixer and lawyer, testifying this past week and describing the ways in which Donald Trump had his hands in virtually every decision that the Trump organization made, including financial issues. Plainly, Michael Cohen's subject to an awful lot of cross-examination. He himself, having lied before the United States Congress, having been convicted previously of federal felonies related to the hush money scheme and other matters related to that testimonial appearance before the Congress, subject to a lot of cross-examination, but also called by the state. What for the purpose of, again, providing information about how the Trump Organization works, Michael Cohen appearing on the stand this past week on behalf of the government in support of a finding by the court that the government has proven its case about the fraudulent and misrepresented values of properties, which is the subject matter of this civil case brought by the state. The reason why that's important, it also goes back to the exchange and the problem that the defendant, Donald Trump, had that caught the attention of the judge. And once again, going back to Dick's good point, we know that the judge had previously told Donald Trump he cannot talk about court staff in a dismissive or objecting fashion. And in particular, he had previously made reference to the court's law clerk, suggesting inappropriately that she had a romantic relationship with Chuck Schumer. Completely wrong, completely unfounded. And the judge directed the defendant, Donald Trump, only to take that down. But when he didn't, he fined him $5,000. It came back again this week in a derivative way related indirectly to Michael Cohen. What happens is that after Michael Cohen is testifying, Donald Trump goes out into the hallway right outside of the courtroom itself, and he engages with the media, as he often does, and he calls Justice Engoron partisan, which, believe it or not, is not within the prohibition, the express prohibition of the order directing the defendant not to provide verbal statements like this in the public domain. But then Donald Trump goes on to add that the judge is also with a person who is very partisan sitting alongside him, perhaps even more partisan than he is. And the judge hears about this almost immediately and says, well, that's my law clerk. My law clerk is right here. I told you before not to talk about her in the public domain. And the judge calls Donald Trump to the stand, places him on the stand under oath, and questions him. And along the way, Donald Trump and his attorneys say, Donald Trump wasn't talking about your law clerk. He was talking about Michael Cohen, the witness who was previously on the stand, which is an incredible position to take. The judge says just that. He says, I do not believe this witness. What the witness is describing, the witness who's also the defendant, is simply wrong. I'm very protective of my staff, Judge Engoron says. I don't want anybody killed, and responds that the target of the comments was clear. It was his law clerk. And he calls this hearing, does this evidentiary hearing without the jury present, which is appropriate, and ultimately fines Donald Trump $10,000. So now his debt to the court there is $15,000 all told. And the judge plainly upset once again by these statements by Donald Trump. To Dick's point, one of the other remedies that is also available to this judge and the next judge we'll talk about is to jail someone who is engaging in contempt of these orders. We'll see how far Judge Engoron permits Donald Trump to go if he continues down this line. Now he's got this $15,000 debt due and owing to the court because of things he's said in the public domain. Dick also noted some other activities in addition to this major statement by the judge that the defendant has once again violated the gag order, also entertaining before the jury this very important litigation testimony from Michael Cohen, the former fixer and former attorney. By the way, the attorney general afterwards said, you know, he is not the principal core of our case. And indeed, if he was, the case would be in some some jeopardy because this trial should not be focused upon someone who has that much baggage identified by the defendant, much more than just the Michael Cohen testimony. But his is the one that attracts a lot of the media attention because he has been in the media. He continues to appear not only through his book sales and his book promotions, but also on the media on a regular basis, decrying Donald Trump and bemoaning his past association. All that continues to happen. And this past week, again, this amazing confrontation between Michael Cohen and Donald Trump in the courtroom, one-on-one, looking at each other, confronting each other in a way that they have not for several years, at least not in this kind of forum. Along the way, the same judge, Judge Engoron, who fines Donald Trump an additional $10,000 for making this reference to his law clerk,
notwithstanding Donald Trump's report, his codification, his description of his inappropriate comments as being referring to Michael Cohen. Beyond that, the judge just yesterday also issued an important order directing Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump's daughter, to testify at trial. That's going to happen this coming week. She was also a previous defendant in this case. She was a part of this lawsuit, but she won dismissal by an appeals court early this year on the basis that her ties to the corporation and the allegations in the complaint, the civil complaint, were not sufficiently strong to support all of that. Her lawyer now argues that the subpoena that was issued by the government, by Letitia James, calling her, like Michael Cohen, like others in this case, to testify, is a form of harassment. That's what her attorney said, and therefore should not be a part of the litigation coming up this coming week. The judge denied that. He said that Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, has to testify. And again, in support of the government's case, that there were fraudulent representations made about the values of these various properties. This civil fraud lawsuit going on in the case, we are going to anticipate that Ivanka Trump, a non-defendant but plainly affiliated in some ways with the Trump organization in the past, is going to testify this coming week. We'll hear more about that before Judge Arthur Engoron this coming week in the New York State Court, being prosecuted once again civilly by the Attorney General there. We go now to Washington, D.C., another aspect of these so-called gag orders, an expression I'm not particularly fond of because it suggests that there are violations of First Amendment rights being undertaken by the judges. And in fact, they're not gagging someone in an appropriate way. They're restricting them, as they would any defendant, from saying things that would be inconsistent with the due process that we've talked about this morning, the equal protection, if you will, more directly, the legitimate attempts to ensure that justice is done in court. And how do you do that? You do that by ensuring that witnesses are not intimidated, that a jury pool is not in some way sullied by concerns about what they're going to be hearing, that they are not in any way affected by the statements of people involved in the litigation, that the rule of law is promoted during the course of these trials. And so we know that Judge Tanya Chutkan, she is presiding over the federal case in the District of Columbia, not New York, in federal case in federal court in the District of Columbia. This is the major January 6th insurrection case. This is the interference with the 2020 vote count on January 6th. Donald Trump, the singular criminal defendant in that case, not yet going to trial, probably in the spring of this coming year. In that connection, the government, Jack Smith, the special counsel prosecuting that case, has asked the judge, indeed she did impose an order directing that he not comment about witnesses, that he not comment about the future jury pool, that he not comment about the prosecutors and others involved in this litigation. And the judge entered that order, directing him not to do that based upon things he has said on his own website, on his own social media platform, Truth Social. In fact, the government came back again this week and said, Judge, not only do you need to enforce that order that you previously established, that order now on appeal from Donald Trump, and in the interim, the judge has suspended that order while the appeals court takes a look at it. The federal government coming back and saying, Judge, while that is pending, you need to reinforce this. You need to put it back in place, lift your stay of your order, and enforce the order right now. Why? Because, again, according to the pleadings filed in the federal court there, Jack Smith saying that in the context of statements made by the defendant, Donald Trump, he's now calling Jack Smith deranged, as he has before. He's weighed in about testimony attributed to his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, who could also be a witness in this federal case. We're going to talk about that in just a few moments or so. Talking about all of these kinds of things, he's threatening witnesses in the case. And again, according to the government, attempting to prejudice the conduct of the trial itself. And the court, in particular, is hearing this from the government. Unless the court lifts the administrative stay imposed, the defendant will harm and prejudice the future of these cases. Trump's messages in the past, as I've said, called out various people who've cooperated with the authorities in this case. He's called them cowards. He's called them weaklings. And although he hastens to add, he says this, I don't think Mark Meadows is one of them, but who really knows? Who really knows? And that's the focus of the latest attempt by the government to get Judge Chutkan to basically reinstate her order that she suspended while it's on appeal, coming back to the court now and saying, this can't continue. We can't wait anymore for the Court of Appeals to issue its decision, presumably affirming that this is not a violation of any First Amendment right owed and owned by the defendant himself. This is simply the administration of justice. We'll see what Judge Chutkan does. She's giving the defense a bit of an opportunity to respond. It may, in fact, be. She is not obliged to stay her order while it's on appeal. She did that out of an abundance of caution. But it may well be that she'll rescind that order, impose it, and Donald Trump may be in some significant further trouble, as he plainly is in front of the state court judge, Judge Engoron, up the street in New York City. We'll see what how this plays out in the future. As I indicated, the other big news coming out of that trial, although only indirectly, reporting from ABC News and others that Mark Meadows, one of the potential witnesses in that federal case, the former chief of staff, is now in some way cooperating with the federal government. Mark Meadows, again, not a defendant, a named defendant in that federal case, is a named defendant in the Georgia case, but not in the federal case. And what comes out this past week? We begin to learn, again, from reporting, not officially, not from Jack Smith, not from the government, not from Mark Meadows or his attorneys themselves, but that Mark Meadows has received immunity from future prosecution. We don't know exactly the breadth of that, the scope of that, but it's appropriate this morning to talk a little bit about what immunity means and how that's different what's going on in Georgia. We know in Georgia some of those defendants, including, yes, Sidney Powell and this fellow named Ken Chesbrough, and just this past week as well, another attorney named Jenna Ellis also pleading guilty in that case, apologizing to the people of the state of Georgia for her conduct. That's all going on there. Those people are entering into plea agreements, admitting to their offense conduct there in cases that have been charged against them, admitting the underlying conduct with which they've been charged, and receiving sentences in all those cases not involving prison terms. In the federal case, again, the only defendant charged is the defendant, Donald Trump, and Mark Meadows presumably identified as a witness in that case, as a witness in the trial that probably will be taking place sometime in the spring of this coming year. Well, along the way, again, the media this past week reports that he has been given immunity. Again, no charges. There is not a plea agreement here with respect to the federal government, but immunity, an immunity grant. And we know that under the Fifth Amendment, anybody who is charged with a crime has a Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, can't be forced to reveal incriminating information about themselves, even if they're asked by law enforcement to do so. Right after the break, we're going to talk more about what that means in connection with this report that Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff, has been granted immunity in connection with the continuing investigation, presumably the trial down the road in federal court. Stay with us for that discussion and that reporting, that civics reporting, that law school reporting this morning on Morning Cannolis.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and then the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Time out!
All right! Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Here's your updated forecast. High of 35 this afternoon. Under cloudy skies, winds out of the west, 8 to 15 miles per hour. Chance for snow tonight, 22. Tomorrow, high of 35. About an inch of snow Monday night. I'm meteorologist Paul Trombley on Lake Air, WLAK, 1260 AM. Right now, 30.
Broadcasting from atop the water tower. Well, not really, but it sounds fun. This is Lake Air, 1260 AM, WLAK. Amory's radio station, 1.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM. This is The Shaw, WAUK.
We're back for this, our final segment on Morning Cannolis. We're doing some civics, some law school in this final segment. We're talking about immunity because of these reports coming out of the media that Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff while Donald Trump was our president, has received immunity from prosecution and that he's apparently providing information to Jack Smith in connection with the investigation, certainly the upcoming trial in federal court alleging election interference. And in particular, the reporting is that the former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, is saying that Trump was dishonest when he claimed to have won the election just hours after the polls closed. Meadows reportedly telling the prosecutors, obviously, we didn't win, and that he conveyed that to Donald Trump almost immediately after the election was concluded in November of 2020. That's significant for a number of reasons, because, of course, Mark Meadows has been among the most articulate defenders of the former president and actually helped perpetuate this lie that the 2020 election had been stolen. He actually was among the people who set up this phone call with Georgia officials in which Donald Trump asked the Secretary of State there to find sufficient votes to declare him a winner there under the Electoral College, and apparently sort of stood passively by as Donald Trump refused to call off those supporters who invaded the U.S. Capitol. Lots of things that Mark Meadows knows about, is involved with, presumably other things as well. Mark Meadows has also written a book called The Chief's Chief, and he also stated clearly in that book that the Trump position was accurate and it's right, and that the election was rigged, and that there was actual evidence of fraud. Presumably, that is not his true belief. And it appears that he is now providing information to the contrary to the federal investigators, Jack Smith, under this grant of immunity from future prosecution. So what does that mean? Again, we don't know exactly the dimensions of it, but the immunity comes in a couple of forms. It basically means that there are times when a prosecutor, in this case, Jack Smith, can in fact bargain with someone who is suspected of a crime not yet charged. And if that person is believed to have information that is relevant to some other criminal activity in which they're involved, other people are involved, and in exchange for testifying against somebody else, providing some other information, presumably here it's Mark Meadows talking about Donald Trump and other people, that witness, in this case Mark Meadows, can receive immunity from prosecution, shielded from criminal prosecution entirely. And it comes in different types. And again, we don't know exactly what kind of immunity set forth here, but it might be what's called transactional immunity, which is also called total immunity. It basically provides a shield against any future charges based upon the matter that's the subject of that testimony. That's complete. That is a very broad grant of immunity, shielding you from future prosecution. You can still bring charges against that individual for crimes, but it's got to be based upon information, investigative stuff that's gathered outside of the testimonial appearance and the testimony provided by that individual. The criminal justice system, the federal courts, does not offer this kind of immunity lightly. Doesn't happen routinely. But federal prosecutors can, in fact, do that under appropriate circumstances. The other type of immunity, which could also be here,
is called use and derivative use immunity. And it comes with more restrictions than the total bar, if you will. And it protects witnesses from having the prosecution use their statements or any evidence discovered in the wake of those statements based upon those statements against them. Essentially, it produces the same result as if the witness had invoked their Fifth Amendment privilege and did not, in fact, testify at all. Again, it protects them in the way of not permitting the government to use the things that they say against them in any future prosecution. It allows the prosecution to bring charges based upon the same crime as long as those charges are based on entirely different evidence, independent evidence from what's in those statements made under that grant of, once again, use and derivative use immunity. A little bit of civics there, a little bit of law school this morning. The upshot is that Mark Meadows is plainly cooperating, not pursuant to a plea agreement. He hasn't been charged, hasn't pled guilty to anything in federal court, but he is plainly cooperating, if these reports are to be believed, pursuant to this notion of immunity granted to him by the government in this case, so that they can get information plainly that is relevant. And this is the point of all this. Plainly, Jack Smith has identified in Mark Meadows something of great significance and wants him to tell the government, presumably tell a grand jury as well, all about that. We saw the same kind of thing with Fani Willis in Georgia. She's plainly granting the arrangements. She is endorsing and agreeing to these plea agreements with four defendants now in the Georgia case. They have been charged previously. They are agreeing that they engaged in criminal conduct, state criminal conduct there. And she's also soliciting and receiving their testimony, presumably behind closed doors. And how do we know that? Because not only have they said that in court there, but they've also gotten arrangements pursuant to those plea agreements that keep them out of court. And typically, prosecutors do not make those kinds of arrangements, those deals, if you will, pursuant to plea agreements, unless there's something very significant that those witnesses have to say. Presumably, Fani Willis these days is talking a lot to Sidney Powell, and she's talking a lot to Scott Hall and the others there, including Ken Chesbrough, including most recently Jenna Ellis, for the things that all of them have to say there. Highly likely that based upon the things that they're saying, that others among that group might also come forward and say, yes, we'd also like to plead guilty. We'd also like to try, if we can, to stay out of prison, out of Georgia jail for doing what we have done, and maybe also entering into cooperation agreements with you, Madam District Attorney. That could happen down the road, just as it has happened with these four already. But again, different from what's going on with Mark Meadows in the federal system in Washington, D.C., involved now in providing information relevant to the investigation, to the prosecution there, but pursuant to a grant of some kind of immunity there in federal court that would protect the use of his statements at a minimum against him in a future prosecution. Plainly fascinating also to think about the interplay between the Georgia case and the federal case, and whether or not there are discussions going on among the attorneys for the defendants in the Georgia case with Jack Smith. Almost certainly that is the case. Whether or not the attorneys who have negotiated this immunity arrangement in the federal system for Mark Meadows are also talking to Fani Willis for his exposure there in Georgia. Lots of interesting things going on this past week in connection with all of these cases. The state case involving the valuations before Judge Engoron, the two criminal cases, one in Georgia, one in the District of Columbia. And there's also that other federal, that other criminal case similarly pending in New York having to do with hush money. All of those are going to be the subject of our future discussions right here on Morning Cannolis. Thank you so much for joining me this morning as we talk through all of these issues related to the delivery of justice in America, government and law. Have a good week, everybody.
new head coach.
We got one objective and one goal, is to play for a championship.
A talented backfield.
Braylon Allen does it again.
And a defense that just...
Down he goes.
Won't.
Intercepted. He's gone.
Stop.
Another turnover forced.
Join us Saturday. It's a massive matchup in Madison against Ohio State. Our coverage begins at 4:30 on your home for Wisconsin football.
WRJN, 1400 AM, 99.9 FM Racine, and 98.1 FM Kenosha.
Say it with me, the Boxing Six. And you can catch every play, every score, every Milwaukee Bucks game on Lake Air Radio, WLAK, 1260 AM in Amory. Your station for the Milwaukee Bucks, your hometown radio refreshed.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK 1260 AM Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian.